Chaver, good afternoon. I am happy to be able to be on the phone with such Choshev Rabbanim, members of our training program, and Gizra Rabbanim around the country, and certainly to welcome Rabbi Mordechai Willig Shlita to be taking these calls. We all know the nature of the shilas that have been presented for today. This is our inaugural conference call. We hope to grow from here together. Again, I want to thank Rabbi for making time for this. And without further ado, Rabbi Willig.
Thank you very much. And again, my apologies for being a little bit late. I pressed the wrong button. The first question, want to know, counting people for a minyan, giving aliyahs, davening for the Yomud, where lines should be drawn, i.e. intermarriage, Shmir Shabbos, etc. And there was a last-minute addition, which is not in the original, although you may have it right now. Not only intermarried people, but about people who are gay, either openly to everyone, or gay who only told his rabbi and close friends, family. This is lemaisa for me now. I will try to address these questions. One has to take things in context. Bale Avera, not a new phenomenon in Klal Yisrael. Not at all. The Rambam writes, in every community there were those who were involved in Arayas and those involved in other bad things. And there's obviously a case law, as we like to call it, on these type of situations. For example, let's begin. I'm going to give the sources. You can look it up at your convenience. The Mishnah Berurah discusses something along these lines in Orach Chaim, Simen Kuf Lamed Ches, Sif Katan Hey. But the Mishnah Berurah writes that an individual who is suspected of being in violation of a particular Avera, you don't call him up for an Aliyah for that particular Parsha. Lo Yikra L'Misha Choshed Al Arayas, the Parsha's Arayas, indicating that any other Parsha, which is not Parsha's Arayas, someone who's Choshed Al Arayas, may in fact be called to the Torah. That's the initial source. Nishari Ephraim, which is the main sefer on Hilchos Kriyas HaTorah, in Shar Aleph, Simen Lamed Aleph, he has a discussion about this. That's only someone who is chashut, who is suspected. What if we know for a fact that he is guilty of arayas? So he writes, well, perhaps we should call him up for this particular parsha, because if there's a doubt, we don't want to embarrass him for nothing. If you know for a fact, perhaps if we embarrass him, he'll do tshuva. If it won't help, then there's no point of calling him up. Moreover, these are the mefarshim of the Shari Ephraim. If it's mefursim lebala veira, she'osu befarhesya, ve'ein boshes, eino mevorech eleminites. So on the contrary, if he's a bala veira, who has no shame, he does it publicly, then his bracha is no bracha, and clearly he should not be called for an aliyah of any type. Now, where do you draw the line? There's a compendium, which you, I'm sure, are familiar with, called the Piskei Tshuvas. He talks about this in his commentary in Simen Kuf Lamed Vav, footnote 10. There he says, quoting the Shari Ephraim, and he says, there are some people, quoting the Chacham Tzvi, who do bad things. Ein adas ovelas yitnu lehem aliyos the Torah. Can't do it. Now, how do you define? Who decides these things? Quote, ha'achlata bazet tluya bekama bekama pratim. What are the pratim? One, han ha'gosso shel zeh ha'rosa la'as the Torah. What kind of sinner is he? Two, what impression will it make if this person is called to an aliyah? What will be the result? Okay. And therefore, who determines this? Again, the Mefarshim and Sharif Ephraim say, it all depends. Hakol toli b'ro'os einei ha'dayan. The dayan here is you. The rabbi of the shul has to make this critical decision. Now, it depends on the sinner and depends upon the community. obviously some communities are much more open than others. There are communities that exist where, I should say, most people are not keeping Shabbos properly. So it's hard to say that someone not keeping Shabbos properly can't get an aliyah. That means there's no Kriyas HaTorah at all. On the other hand, there are shuls where a lack of Shemir Shabbos is completely intolerable. It depends on the circumstances and on the context. Of course, it depends in part on whether it's Befarhesi or Betzina. Same with intermarriage. I think that, generally speaking, we view intermarriage more seriously than Shemir Shabbos, not because of the Chomer or Iser. Chilul Shabbos is an Iser Skila, and marrying a non-Jewish woman is not an Iser Skila. But as the Rambam has written in Hilchos Yisur Rabia, we don't always measure things by the severity of the onesh, but rather the impact it has on the community. Intermarriage, especially in that direction of a man, talking about a Jewish man here, married to a non-Jewish woman, the children are not Jewish, is a horrific violation of the very essential responsibility of a Jewish person, and therefore it's much more serious in broader terms, even if technically speaking the onesh is not so severe. So there may be shuls where someone who's mechalel Shabbos, even if it's well known, will get an aliyah, and someone who's intermarried will not, again, depending on the decision of the Rav, again, depending on the individual, depending upon the community. In some communities, unfortunately, intermarriage is rampant, and it's somehow become, quote-unquote, accepted, even though it's not an accepted fact as permissible, but it's a reality that people are tinok shenishba, they don't know any better, they weren't brought up properly. So that's the rabbi's decision to allow even such a thing. But if it hasn't reached that level, then presumably one should stand strong and say someone who's intermarried should not be called up to the Torah. Even if he perhaps is a tinok shenishba, nonetheless, it depends upon the impression it conveys on the individual sinner, on the community at large. Some may come to an erroneous conclusion that if the rabbi allows this person to get an aliyah, then fill in the blank. Chilul Shabbos is okay, intermarriage is okay, and the rabbi has to make a decision based on his own particular circumstances. The final question about gay, openly gay, not openly gay, I believe that gay is not a category unto itself. You know, there's a lot of talk about that nowadays, that somehow the Rabbanim accused of being homophobic. I don't believe that we have to treat this violation any differently than we treat any other arayas violation, intermarriage, adultery, non-marital. These are all violations of different levels of severity. And we have to be strong and say this is not acceptable in our communities. If saying it's not acceptable in our communities includes preventing such a person from receiving an aliyah, then so be it. That's the rabbi's decision. He has to make that decision in order to preserve a certain standard in his community. If he feels somehow that the battle's been lost and he's no longer able to prevent particular Bali Aver of any of the types that we mentioned until now from getting aliyahs, it's too late, the battle's been lost already, then it's permissible technically. As we saw before, someone who's over in Gili Arayas, the poskim say that it's not an absolute prohibition to give him such an aliyah. There are those who say, oh, it's terrible, it's a menayit. What they mean is, he's a befarhesya, and unfortunately some of these averis, they call today pride, and in your face, and we demand to be accepted on our own terms. So Rav has to know that's a bigger problem. Whether it's the aver of Shemir Shabbos, I insist that you accept me as a mechalel Shabbos, you know, or as an adulterer, or as an intermarried, you name it. So someone comes with that attitude, creates a much greater problem. As opposed to someone who, for whatever reason, is temptations that she cannot overcome, desires he cannot control, whatever they may be, in whatever area of life, that's a person who gets more of our sympathy, even though we cannot condone what he's doing, and therefore the Rav may take that into consideration in making this decision. And once again, it depends in large measure on the nature of his community, as the Mefarshim and the Shaar Ephraim point out. That's question number one. Question number two, I'm moving much more quicker than I would otherwise because there's an hour quota to finish all the seven questions. Question two, can one do Bika Cholim or Nicham Avelim over the phone? This is, of course, a complex question, and I was just referring to two sources without going into the details. And the answer is a very nuanced answer in both. Bikur Cholim is discussed in Sefer Igros Moshe, Yoredeya, Chelek Aleph, Simen, Reish, Chof, Gimel. And the fundamental answer is that Bikur Cholim has many aspects. One aspect is to provide service for the Cholim. That's hard to do over the phone, you can accomplish much more in person. Another is to pray for the person who's sick. Presumably if you're there, the person's prayers are more efficacious. Also hard to do that over the phone. The third element of cheering him up, giving him chizuk, this can be done at least partially over the phone. So therefore the bottom line is, if a person can fulfill Bikur Cholim in its entirety in full measure by doing it in person, he should certainly do so. If he's unable to, a phone call is certainly appropriate for a partial fulfillment of Bikur Cholim. Similarly, in Igros Moshe Or HaChaim, Chelek Dalid, Simen Mem, Os Yud Aleph, it's entitled, Nicham Avelim, Idea Telephone. And here, once again, Nicham Avelim has different aspects. There was a question of Kvod HaChaim, there's Kvod HaMesim. Rav Moshe says, I quote, Umash Mali, so Rav Moshe again splits over here. He says that you can have one aspect on the phone and one you don't. So once again, if you can go, it's better to go. If you cannot, certainly picking up the phone is a partial fulfillment of this mitzvah. Let's go to the third question. Can my doorman press the elevator button for me on Shabbat? It's a complicated question. There is a major dispute in the poskim when a person completes an electric circuit, which is what's required to start an elevator. That's what you do when you press the button. Is that an Issa b'derabbanan or an Issa b'deraisa? Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Zal writes it's derabbanan in Mincha Shlomo, and he quotes a correspondence he had with the Chazon Ish, Zal, who held, it is a din d'oraisa, any electric circuit. This has great impact on our shaila, because one of the general rules that we have is that one may be involved in what we call a shvus d'shvus b'makom mitzvah. So if a person, for example, is going to shul, or is coming back home and is going to have a sudas mitzvah, make kiddush, that's a makom mitzvah. So if you assume that the prohibition of completing an electric circuit is a din derabbanan, and a classical case of shvus to shvus b'makom mitzvah, which is permissible in some cases, cannot be permissible lechatchila. Ideally, a person should avoid this, and therefore, if he's able to walk up and down the steps, he certainly should do so. But if it's impossible, there are leniencies. I should add, Chacham Eina Barosho, a person should not purchase an apartment or rent an apartment on a very high floor where he cannot walk, because he's putting himself in a situation, the Chatchila, of having to have a guy press the button, which is not permissible unless it's a Shas HaTzchak. He had no right to put himself into this Shas HaTzchak, unless the building has a Shabbos elevator, which is a different story. So therefore, assuming that it's a din derabbanan, is a possibility of shvus to shvus b'mokom mitzvah. Not to go into a long pilpul, but in the simple pshat, shvus to shvus b'mokom mitzvah, it's hard to understand why that should be so. If shvus to shvus is also, let it be also even b'mokom mitzvah, what's the difference? So my answer, which I've written in my Sefer on Shabbos, is as follows. There are two problems if you tell a guy to do something. One is he's considered to be your shaliach, and two is an issa v'daber dover. So if a person does it for a mitzvah, this eliminates the Isra v'daber davar, because it's dibush al mitzvah. He's still left with the Isra of shlichus. He is considered to be your agent to push the button. And even if you don't even tell him to push the button, he does it every single week, quoted in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Shin Chaf Hei, that's also considered to be your shlich, even if you don't exchange a single word. He knows to do it on a regular basis. However, it seems to me that this question of Shlichus is a bayad lo ifshita in Masechta Bava Metzia Daf Tzadi. Talks about lo sachsam shor b'disho. And as such, the general rule is, we are makil when it's ikra de rabbana, and machmir by ikra de oraisa. Therefore, you cannot tell the goy mitzad shlichus to do with the oraisa, but the rabbana, you may tell the goy to do. But the shvus, it knocks out the Easter of shlichus, and the makam mitzvah knocks out the Easter of v'dabedava. However, the makam rohamites and simon yud aleph, we don't allow a sveka de rabbanon lechatchila, only for stuck. Therefore, we should try to avoid this in any event. Particularly in this case, as I mentioned to you before, the Chazon Ish is of the opinion that electricity is a doraisa, and if it's a doraisa, then it's generally speaking prohibited to ask a goy to do something for you on a doraisa, unless the person is considered to be a chole, even a chole shein bo sakana, then even if it's a doraisa, it's permissible to do it through a goy for any particular purpose. So to summarize, for a non-chole, we should certainly do our best to avoid this situation. Avoid going up to high floors. Don't rent or buy on a high floor. If you're invited, say no. There's nothing wrong with saying no. And if you have no choice but to be on a high floor, if you're able to walk, you should walk. If you're unable to, you know, there are those who can walk down but not walk up. That's also good. Walking down in halachic world is a bigger problem Going down the elevator is a bigger problem than going up, as the Shmir Shabbos Kachosa elaborates upon in great length. So you should certainly try to walk down. You should even try to walk up. Those are in good shape. You can walk, it's easy to walk. Just take your time. Personally, has very little choice. It's permissible to rely on the Mekilim. The electricity is a Rabbanan. Hence, a Shvus to Shvus to Mok a Mitzvah. So you can go up the elevator when the doorman presses the button. But again, it's only if it's unavoidable. If you're able to walk, you should do so. If someone is a chola, even able sakana, then there's much more room to be lenient, because even in the case that it really is a daraisa, we are makel for a chola. That's question number three. Question number four is about talamutter, very pertinent right now. And the question was raised, what if a person remembers talamutter after he finished Shema Tefillah, before he started the word Ritzei, what does he do? So the Shulchan Aruch writes in Simon Kuf Yud Zayin Sif Hey, and I quote, V'im nizkar acha shechosam Shema Tefillah, kodem shisle Ritzei, nire she'omer v'sein talamotar v'chakach omer Ritzei. So therefore, the answer is found over here, that you should say talamotar levrocha right there. Okay, question number five. Due to Obamacare, a young couple about to get married according to halacha are debating not to get married civilly so that they can remain on their parents' health plan. Is it mutter? Can a rabbi misayak kedushin for such a wedding? Now, the word mutter. Mutter in halacha, of course, is mutter, but we have to observe the law of the land. We're not permitted to go against the law of the land. To the best of my knowledge, it is prohibited by the law of the land for a clergyman to officiate at a wedding without a marriage license. And therefore, if it is in fact prohibited by the law of the land, and since every state has its own rules and regulations, a rabbi is duty-bound to consult with the state law to find out if it's permissible or not. If it's permissible, the halacha, of course, has no objection. If it is prohibited, the rabbi should not be doing such a thing. So you'll ask, well, what's the poor chosn kala supposed to do if they feel they have no alternative? A number of years back, a somewhat similar situation existed. The details don't matter right now. But once again, the individual who asked the question was told, a rabbi, this is New York State, if he does such a thing, it's a misdemeanor, and rabbis should not be committing the misdemeanors, which are crimes, of low-level crimes, and therefore the rabbi may not do it. However, legal counsel in New York State at the time, and you have to check to make sure it's still current, indicated that this violation of New York State law can only be violated by a clergyman, an ordained rabbi or other religious member of the clergy. However, someone who is not a clergyman, by definition, is excluded from the statute and is not covered by it. And therefore, if there's a need for a couple to get married halachically and not by the law of the state of New York, the way that it can be done, this is what I was told by legal counsel some while ago, and you know, double check to make sure it's still true, is that the person who officiates at the wedding should not be a member of the clergy. Now, in other religions, this may not work, but for us, as you probably are aware, you don't need anybody. The chos can marry the kalah by himself without any Masada Kedusha. As long as he just gives her a ring and says the, you know, says the bracha, says the harayat, it's perfectly valid. Not the way we do things under normal conditions. But therefore, if a person wants to get married in such a way, my best legal information is, and I know my limitations, you have to check again, is that you as a rabbi may not do it according to New York State law. And I'm told that almost every state, if not every, has the same law. However, a non-member of the clergy could be learned. It could be someone who knows what's going on in Hilchos Kiddushin. Or it's not even a problem if the rabbi is coaching him. As long as the official individual who's performing the wedding as such, as it's defined in the state terms, the one who presumably says the bracha, and who tells the chosn to give the ring to the kala and quote-unquote presides over the ceremony, if that individual is not a member of the clergy, so to the best of my understanding of the law, this is not a violation of the laws of New York State, and I don't think of any other jurisdiction either. You have to double-check. And that's the advice that should be given to such a couple, if they would decide to do that, that they should find someone who is a learned individual whom they know, who is not a member of the clergy. You can bone up on the laws of Siddur Kiddushin. A rabbi such as yourself could be in the background, just helping out in case there's some kind of a emergency or something else goes wrong or there's a question. But you yourself should not do it because it's not a proper according to the laws of the land in the United States of America, to the best of my knowledge. We now come to the last question. I saved the most time for the last question because it's the most difficult question of them all. I will read it verbatim. I often receive this.
Rabbi, question six.
Oh, excuse me. I skipped number six. My apologies. A widower with children wants to be buried next to his second wife and not the mother of his children. The children have come to the Rav to express their opinion, even though they really like their stepmother. No children were born in the second marriage, and the children were orphaned as teenagers when the father remarried. How should the Rav proceed? It's not clear whether the second wife is alive at the present time or not. The first line sounds like she's no longer alive. The second line sounds like she is alive. I don't think it really makes that much of a difference. May make a little bit of a difference. But in any event, there's a contradiction between what the children perceive as kibbutz eim, that's proper honor accorded to their mother, the deceased mother, that her husband, their father, should be buried next to their mother. After all, that's traditional, that a man who marries twice is buried next to the woman who bore him children, if only one of the two did. On the other hand, the father, for whatever reason, decided he wants to be buried next to his second wife. Maybe she died already. Maybe she's, he wants to be buried in a different place to be buried next to her, not near his first wife. So what should the Rav tell the children? Well, it seems to me that although I usually, tradition is we bury the husband near the wife through whom he was privileged to have children. It's not etched in stone. It's not a halacha l'moshe m'Sinai. And it's not a violation of halacha for the father to wish to be buried next to his second wife. The reasons we can only surmise, maybe guess, maybe he, let's take a simple case. It says over here that they were orphaned as teenagers. So it's possible that he was married to his first wife for a total of 15 years. right? Children were teenagers. They were 14. They were 13. And then this marriage only lasted 15 years. He remarried shortly thereafter. And he's married to a second wife for 40 years. So he feels it's not right that he should be buried next to his first wife, whom he hasn't seen in over 40 years, and leave the other wife, whom he's been together with for 40 good years, just no children. He doesn't think it's right, ethically, morally, whatever he has in his mind. The father's request is legitimate. It's not a violation of any halacha. And therefore, the Rav should tell the children that although perhaps traditionally it's generally assumed that a man is going to be buried next to the wife from whom he had children, it's not a halacha. It's usually a preference. And in this particular case that the father decided otherwise, the children should respect their father's request, even if they consider it to be somehow somehow minimizing the respect they would like to accord to their deceased mother. The Gemara in Kiddushin tells us that after, on a simple level, after there is a termination of the marriage, there's no preference for father over mother or vice versa, but generally there is a preference for someone who's alive over someone who is deceased. Now, obviously, the burial is not going to take place till after the father is deceased as well. But if all the arrangements are made during his lifetime, it's not so easy to overturn them. Maybe even illegal in certain cases. So I believe that the rabbi should counsel these children as much as they mean for the covenant of their mother. They should be what we call b'shev al-tasa. And if in fact that's their father's decision, they should respect it and recognize that it's in no way a dishonor to their mother. Just let's assume the case I gave. It's not a way of dishonor. Unfortunately, Hashem took her at an early age after, let's assume, a short relationship with their father, and it's a much longer one with his second wife, and they like the second wife, the stepmother. So they should just say nothing, and if that's the father's decision, should let it ride. I once had a case where a woman came to me. She was married for a very short time, and her husband passed away after a very brief time, and they had one son. This one son, Ben Yochid, was the closest person to his mother for 50-something years. The husband she knew for maybe 10 years. And then, unfortunately, he predeceased her. She came to me, she said, you know, I really want to be buried next to my son. Him I knew for 50-something years. My husband, I knew for less than 10 years. So that's even more irregular to be buried next to a son as opposed to next to a late husband. But here too, if that was her request, that's what should be honored. That's question number 6. Now question number 7. Thank you, Rabbi Hammer, for correcting me. I quote, I often receive this question from people who read blogs. YCT, for those who are unaware, that means Yeshiva Chovevei Torah, bases their argument on this premise. Quote, our fight is not unsimilar to the battles the Hasidim had with the Misnagdim, or Beis Yaakov's had with the Torah world. The context of time will prove us right. Sometimes to create change, we need fighters. End quote. How do you respond to this? Let's analyze them one by one. Take the Beis Yaakov innovation, since that's more recent, that's less than 100 years old. Let's analyze what happened. What was it? What was the innovation? What was the opposition? And how was it resolved? So as you all know, there was a lady named Sarah Schneerer who saw that after World War I, there was a terrible, terrible dislocation of the youth, male and female, and especially the female youth who were much more tethered to their parents' homes and had no yeshiva setting to enter into. This dislocation had horrific implications. Many, many, many were falling by the wayside, becoming irreligious. There was no anchor for them. And she decided that the only solution is to establish a school for Jewish women to teach them Jewish subjects and whatever they had to know. Fine. It was quite revolutionary at the time. And she was preparing her plans. This is written in the biography and other works as well. Her brother, who, as she was a chassid of the Belzer Rebbe, said, "You can't do that. Who are you? You're just a whippersnapper. You're going to decide such a major issue on your own? You have to ask the Rebbe." She said, "Okay, we'll ask the Rebbe." And the Belzer Rebbe was known as a real kanoi, a haredi, whatever you want to call him these days. And the brother was sure that the Rebbe is going to say no, and that'll be the end of the story. And she was willing to say, accept that no as the end of the story, despite the fact that she had put in so much time and effort and even money to plan the founding of a Beis Yaakov school. They went to the Belzer Rebbe together, and the Belzer Rebbe, I believe, changed history, changed the course of history. Instead of saying no, he said two words, Mazel Lebracha. He gave his endorsement to her work. She secured endorsements from the Gerer Rebbe, who was the biggest Hasidus in Europe, as is well known, and from the Holy Chafetz Chaim, as is well known, the acknowledged, universally acknowledged leader of the non-Hasidic Torah world at that period of time. And they all gave these two gave effusive endorsements, and as a result, the Beis Yaakov movement prevailed, notwithstanding the opposition that continued to exist despite the endorsement of these three giants. And the Torah world is not unanimous. We're not monochromatic. There's room for disagreement. But at the end of the day, the Beis Yaakov movement saved Klal Yisrael, and the Gedolei Olam, who endorsed it, realized how important it was, and they gave their endorsement to this rather innovative phenomenon. Yes, there were opponents in the Torah world, no question about it. To this day, in Satmar, for example, they will not teach they have schools, how they do have, but they won't open a Chumash, because if you read this, if you read the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam and the Gemara, it sounds like that Chumash should not be taught to women as a general rule. Except for that particular group, just about every Beis Yaakov does teach Chumash. My particular view is that it never was Usur in the first place. The Rambam's expression is Tivu Chachamim, which if you look throughout Mishneh Torah, you'll find is an Eitzah Tova, not an absolute prohibition. Others disagree and say it's a kind of an Eitz Lasus Hashem Efer Torah Secha, but either way, individuals of that stature are able to endorse innovations even if they depart from the tradition of many, many years. And that's what happened in the case of the Beis Yaakov. The question is what's happening today with the innovations, what's called here the battles of what they call it, what's called here YCT, is it a similar situation? The truth is that the banner of Sarah Schneerer has been raised in other contexts, certain innovations which are in the spirit of feminism, and they say, "Look, Sarah Schneerer did it, so we can do it too. We're just doing the same thing." And the major distinction, which cannot be emphasized enough, is that Sarah Schneerer was willing to take no from an answer from the Belzer Rebbe, and in point of fact, she had endorsements from him and from the Gerer Rebbe and from the Chofetz Chaim, whereas the particular practices that are being set forth by these institutions, I mean, there is a Gerer Rebbe today, there's a Belzer Rebbe today. I mean, the Chofetz Chaim, we have no one of that stature today. Until recently, they could have gone to Rebbe Yoshev, who was considered the leader of the Torah world from a halachic perspective. These individuals have not gone to these Torah leaders, and apparently they believe that either you don't need Torah leaders, or perhaps they view themselves or certain members of their faculties or those who they consult with as Torah leaders, the equivalent of the giants whose names I mentioned. It's not a time to get into any ad hominem characterizations, but suffice it to say that I believe that my listening audience would agree with me that whatever members of the various faculties of these groups do not rise to the level of the Chafetz Chaim and the Rebbes of Belz and Ger of 100 years ago, and therefore the comparison is not apt. It's not the same thing. Now, story of Hasidism, a bit more complex. It started sort of as a folk movement. I'm not going to get involved in all the details of the history of the Heiliger Baal Shem Tov and how he was criticized. But yes, there were certain extremes, and yes, there was a very strong battle against it led by the Vilna Gaon and others. But if you look at the historical picture, perhaps because of these criticisms, there were some correctives. And whereas the initial phenomenon known as Hasidism was a folk movement without much serious emphasis on Torah study, etc., after a generation or two, it began to produce its own Torah giants. Just to give a few examples, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, as it was acknowledged by everyone as a Gadol B'Torah, the Mishnah Berurah quotes him on every page. And as later on it developed, you have giants who've written masterpieces in the halachic world. I'm talking about the Sachachavar Rebbe, the first Ger Rebbe, the second one. These are giants of Torah with a Hasidic background and practices. So therefore, yes, there were still disputes between Hasidim and Misnagdim. We're not sweeping them under the rug. But it can certainly be said that for well over 100 years, the Hasidim have major first rank, I would say we could say 200 years, Hasidim have first rank Talmidei Chachamim amongst their leaders, and notwithstanding critiques from non-Hasidic rabbis, the Gedolei Torah of the world of Hasidus are pillars upon whom one can rely. Therefore, once again, it seems that the comparison is not apt to the what's being put forward in the YCT world. I have to say, and I think it's important we make this distinction, that someone who thinks that at the end of the day, the practices that are being introduced now will be endorsed by some of the leading Torah scholars of the generation. He really thinks that way. I believe he's mistaken. I believe that some of these innovations are dangerous. But someone who disagrees with me and thinks that in due course, the context of time will prove us right. What do you mean by right? Right means that there will be the endorsement of great Torah scholars. I am melamed zchus on such an individual, even though I think he's wrong, but since he thinks his prognostication is different than mine, he really thinks that it's just a matter of time until the great Torah leaders, at least some of them, will come around to that point of view, whatever the particular innovations that are found in the, we'll call the YCT world, and there are many innovations, and let's not paint everyone with one brush, just as I wouldn't want to paint everyone from my own yeshiva in one brush, but there are some significant innovations, certainly in the issue of women's roles in terms of rabbinic or quasi-rabbinic positions, in terms of women's participation in public roles in prayer, other leadership positions, and there are other manifestations. But if a person thinks that in due time, great Torah scholars will come around to endorse these positions because they're not against black letter law, or there'll be some kind of wiggle room within the law, such an individual, I am, quote, melamed zchus on him, that he thinks he's right, and if he thinks he's right, which means he believes that just as the Beis Yaakov movement ultimately prevailed and the Hasidic movement ultimately prevailed as what we call today a legitimate movement, because there were great Torah scholars who endorsed it, okay, we'll take a little bit of time So these interventions will be endorsed. If he feels that way, again, I think he's wrong. If he feels that way, then he's within the system. He believes in a system of tradition, of adherence to the decisions of great Torah scholars, and she thinks it's a matter of time till the traditions will evolve and the Torah scholars will come along, and he thinks that way. Again, I think he's incorrect, but if he thinks that way, Yati Malamitzchus, he's a person who's just, perhaps in my opinion, somewhat misguided. However, there's another strand out there, and I'm not mentioning any names and who's in which strand. There's another strand out there that says we don't need these so-called leading scholars. We reject, a new term I learned recently, top-down halacha. We feel that anyone whose first name is rabbi can decide anything he wants and has a right to be viewed as perfectly legitimate. And indeed, in certain circles, there are attacks against recognized poskim who do not wish to agree with their demands. They're being insensitive, etc. It's part of the idea that if the rabbis only wanted to, they could find a dispensation. This kind of situation is against the whole institution of Amisora. They don't, not that they expect that at a later time greater rabbinic scholars will come around. We don't need greater rabbinic scholars. We're willing to admit that perhaps we may not have the great rabbinic scholars on our side right now, but so what? We don't need him. Every rabbi can do what he wants and innovate whatever he wants. And unfortunately, this is a battle, as the word was used in the question, a battle against the tradition as we know it. And it seems that such individuals who are waging such a battle, the second category for sure, but even the first, can expect opposition. And it's an unfortunate thing that there are people out there from coast to coast who are coming to their sitting rabbis with a list of demands, and they are quite brazen in their nature, some of them, and they view it as a kind of a battle, l'shem shemayim, with no limitations. And unfortunately, they can cause great damage to particular rabbis, to particular communities. How does one respond to this? Frankly, I don't know exactly what the best response is. I believe that a response has to be very nuanced, very, very careful, not just a scream and yell that doesn't help anything, not to start fights doesn't help anything. To try to maintain the traditions of old without giving in to demands which we view as inappropriate, but at the same time, we have to try as best we can to avoid the kinds of public battles between rabbis, which sometimes sink to the personal and they become viewed as petty. It's very, very difficult. I want to make one more comment. If one thinks about the premise that this question has, that, you know, I say what I want to say, and I claim that the context of time will prove us right. This implies, if one wants to be logical, that I can say and do whatever I want. There's no limit. The only arbiter of whether what I'm doing is right or wrong is me. If I think it's right, I think it's going to come around. So the implication is that there's no one in the world who can tell me that what I'm doing is wrong. Now that's what others have written recently, that anyone who claims to be orthodox by definition is orthodox. No one can say that you're not orthodox. Now that's a very troubling proposition. A person can do whatever they want and claim that they're legitimate. So then that means that there's simply no rules and regulations at all. Well, that's sort of what this question is saying. We can do what we want. And that we will claim, at the end of the day, we will be vindicated. It's not so. Any group, call it Baalei Halacha, call it Orthodox Jews, whatever you want to name you want to give to it has to have its own rules and regulations. My Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik would always talk about the importance of Mesorah. And there has to be a boundary somewhere, that if you pass that boundary, you're just not part of the Mesorah community. Sure, there are disputes where the boundary is. And frankly, there's no question that according to some, I'm out of the boundary, you're out of the boundary, and okay, we can handle that. But at the same time, the people on the phone call, I assume, all have some kind of connection to a Mesorah, to a Rebbe, to a yeshiva, which has, you know, it's in turn has its Rebbeim who were trained by recognized Gedolim of the previous generation, and who attempt to adhere to those traditions. In this particular case, I don't see that this is that it's so. There are many members of this camp, and again, I'm being very careful because it's a large camp. The same as our yeshiva is a large camp. We have many more students, but even such a small one has different individuals, and everyone has his own way of doing things. But, you know, the acceptance of certain things which we consider halachically objectionable, call it partnership minyanim, which is now a hot-button issue, call it acceptance of some of the deviants we spoke about earlier as being accepted as full-fledged members of the community without any limitation, notwithstanding an open and defiant posture in these areas. And unfortunately, there are even individuals within that camp, worldly defined, that have recently expressed opinions which have in the past been viewed as heretical based on the Rambam's 13 principles, whether it be denying the Mashiach, whether it be even worse than that. I don't want to go into all those details. In my view, yes, it's true. The premise is true that time will tell. The time will tell whether the opposition of people who feel that these innovations are dangerous, through their opposition, the main body of the individuals of this yeshiva will come closer to what we consider to be traditional in the Mesorah. Perhaps that could be said of the opposition of the Vilna Gaon having that effect on the world of Hasidim. Well, Chas v'Shalom, the people will be drifting further and further away. I cannot predict the future. I think our job is to bring people closer, especially those who deal respectfully towards we'll call the main camp of the Orthodox world. Even if we disagree completely and strongly and vehemently with their innovations, those who have no respect and view themselves as something totally separate, so then it's very difficult to bring them closer. We'd like to, but we hope that they'll come to their senses and in fact come closer to our position, as opposed to drifting further away. I want to end with a little bit of a Dvar Agoda. We're still in the afterglow of Chanukah. If one looks in the Medrash Tanchuma on the Pasuk in Parshas Noso, Bayom HaShvi Nosi Levnei Ephraim, Tanchuma says that a person shouldn't say, I'm not going to light the candles of Chanukah. The Torah doesn't say so. I'm not going to do it. Medrash says, no, it's a mistake. Hashem gave the Rabbanim, the rabbis, the Chazal, the ability to innovate. And if they innovate something, you are required to follow them. And how do you know that? Because Yaakov Avinu put Ephraim before Menashe, as we read this past Shabbos. And Hashem endorsed it when he said, Yom HaShvi, the seventh day, Ephraim. And the eighth day, it's Menashe. What are Chazal telling us over here? I believe the answer is as follows. Who was this Yaakov Avinu? Yaakov Avinu was the individual who was responsible for the establishment of the Mesorah, the father of the Shvatim, who was so loyal, as he indicated in his bracha we read again on Shabbos, to his father and grandfather, v'shem avosai Avraham v'Yitzchak. And if a person who's so loyal to the Mesorah and is so concerned with passing it on, decides on a bold move, such as putting Ephraim before Menashe, then you must listen to what he has to say. However, a different individual who was not so steeped in the Mesorah, who was not so concerned about the traditions of his father and his grandfather, but rather wishes to innovate for the sake of innovation, this is something which is very dangerous and perhaps should not be followed. The Netziv writes that someone who is Osek b'Torah v'mitzvah shelo lishma, Gemara Psachim, is to be lauded mitor shelo lishma bo lishma. But someone who is Osek shelo lishma, the Gemara in Brachas, such an individual is, you know, very bad things to say. Better if he wouldn't have even existed. Why? Explains the Netziv. If you are Osek, that means innovation. Innovation in the world of Torah scholarship, innovation in the world of practice of the religious law, the Kal Vachomer, must be done L'Shem Shemayim. And L'Shem Shemayim requires an understanding of what the Mesorah is, as you'll see in the opening page of the Tshuvas of Rav Moshe. You have to be an expert in the majority of the halachic corpus, Shas and Poskim. You have to work very hard before issuing any halachic decision. You have to think about it very, very carefully, responsibly, not flippantly, not just to go with the flow of the times. This is legitimate halacha, and yes, as my Rebbe would say, legitimate chiddush. However, without these prerequisites, such chiddushim are dangerous, and we should try our best to stay far away. So again, to go back to the original question, I don't have the power of prophecy. My personal leaning is that these innovations will not get the endorsement of the great Torah scholars going forward. If I'm proven wrong, and the great scholars of the future will endorse some of these activities, then I will have been proven wrong. But an individual who disagrees with me on that and says he thinks that these great scholars will approve of these ideas, I have a limud zchus on him. He thinks so. I think he's wrong. He's misguided. He thinks he's right. Fine. But individuals who don't care about what the great Torah scholars say, they say we can do whatever we want. And we are, quote-unquote, orthodox because we say so. And we claim that the tradition will, in fact, prove us right down the road. That's a very, very dangerous attitude, I believe, and unfortunately it may lead to a further drifting away from our traditions. So, on the one hand, we have to be optimistic. On the other hand, I believe that the rabbonim in the field have to continue to oppose innovations which they think are invalid, and to explain to the proponents of these changes who claim that they're going to be, context of time will prove us right, quote-unquote, that you don't really think so. But again, if they're coming with respect and they really think that they're going to be endorsed by great Torah scholars at the end of the day, you should certainly treat them with great respect. If they're coming with defiance and attempt to undermine the tradition and with brazen requests, you have to be much more careful in your attitude towards them. I'm not saying to involve oneself in character assassination, but one has to be aware. If someone is trying to undermine the system as we know it, we have to be extra careful in our response. My time is up. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Willig. Chaver, we'll try to do this again next week. You'll be in touch by email. This has been recorded, and if anyone would like to have a copy of this recording, you could email me at rabbis@youngisrael.org. Have a good day. Zeigebetsch. Take care.